Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 10th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum. And after several programs with weak attendance records, we are back to the full panel today. And oh, how exciting is that? Give us a call now if you have a science question. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You may also email us if you so desire. It is voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll try to get to every email. I can't guarantee that, but we'll do our best. The number is 800-348-2551. Science. 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 Today after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum. And, you know, this is always an exciting place to work. There's always something exciting going on. But today ranks as one of the most exciting in recent memory because we have the entire science panel back today. And I can't tell you how thrilled I am. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is the number. And you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org, if you have a science question. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. As we customarily do on this program, let's have our panel of experts sign in, please.
Oh, it's Barbara Bravitz.
Oh, wait, hang on. We'll turn the microphone on. There we go. I threw Zach a curveball. We went clockwise today. Apologize.
Sorry, Zach. It's Barbara Bravitz from SUNY Cobleskill. I'm a biochemist, and I am up for biology and chemistry today.
Yeah. I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist here after 2 months of
can I just say
off and doing other
how
things.
Great it is to have you back.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Everyone here is just so thrilled to have you back.
Well, except for Ed.
I know. Ed's got some issues about this. All right. And who else is here?
Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill. I am not a chemist. I do geology and astronomy and anything that Jim Pickett cannot answer.
Oh.
And suffers from middle child syndrome, apparently.
Yeah, I guess so. Wow. All right. So we got some, everybody's
hostility
happy.
Hostility here.
Yeah. Where you been, Jim?
Well, two months ago I was at my daughter's college family weekend.
All right. That's an acceptable excuse.
And last month I was at a conference in Colorado.
Not quite as acceptable, but we'll take it anyway, and good to have you back. Well, the two professors here.
Yes, it's finals week.
You look a little frazzled.
Little beat?
Yeah.
I'm just beat. I'm not really frazzled, just beaten down. I killed a pen about an hour before I got here, where it was out of ink in the middle of an exam. I had to throw it out and start new.
That's exciting, but it's done now.
No, the grading. No, all the taking is done. The grading is not.
You don't have robots to do that yet?
Call me when you've got one or you hear about one because I could use one.
It's not really grading. It's more degrading. But, I've had a lineup outside my office for the whole day of people saying, did I pass?
Make them wait.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should do the Pope thing with the white smoke or the darker smoke.
You know, maybe I should burn the papers and see if they give off the proper color.
There you go. That would also be scientific. Well, we're off to a flying start.
He's kidding, students.
Here on the Science Forum. Barbara Bravitz, Jim Pickett, Ed Stander here to answer your questions. And,
as long as they're not on the test.
Let's go to the phones. And Samantha in Red Hook. Samantha, you're on.
Well, I'm glad you're already laughing because I've got kind of a doozy, and really it's less of a question, more of a catalyst for a conversation.
Okay.
I am extremely interested in the oversimplification that everything is everything, rather everything is energy. And
then you called the right show. This is an oversimplification show. Go for it.
Okay, so. Rather than stutter and try to meander my way through the nomenclature, I would rather ask, since the whole panel's there and it's perfect timing, really, I just really wanted to go over, I'm just going to give you a couple of things, consciousness, also how it networks with our environment and our universe, essentially.
Well, I mean, these are tough questions. I'm so glad Jim Pickett is here.
Existentialism is not a science.
That's so funny that you said that. I was going to preface with, you know, this is an existential type person-ish calling with a spirit science question, really. As drinking the same water that dinosaurs once drank. You know, it's recycled and so on and so forth. And maybe stop me right there if that's misinformed.
No, that's true.
No, I'm drinking the same bourbon that dinosaurs drank.
There you go. So I'm wondering that it's fermented, right? Then I'm wondering if energy, again, an oversimplification, is somewhat similar, and water, I guess, would be under that umbrella, but under the umbrella. But anyway, really, I just am wondering if that energy is comparable or parallels water in that way. That there's a certain amount of energy. We can't necessarily quantify it, but is it the same amount? And does it just change black holes develop and
energy,
so on and so forth and all?
Yeah, I can talk about the energy part.
Okay.
The energy kind of always runs runs downhill in that.
Okay.
Because of entropy, every time energy is used, it is degraded. It goes down a step in its quality, gets spread out more. So it's not conserved in the same way that a water molecule is conserved. It gets dissipated. So the high quality sunlight that comes from the sun gets degraded into low energy heat that gets re-radiated out into space.
Okay.
So it's not as if the energy doesn't actually get lost, but it gets more and more diluted, more and more degraded.
And just to be clear, the law of conservation of energy says that energy is neither created nor destroyed. It's just really changed from one form to another using this degradation process with these three factors: heat, temperature, and entropy. Yep. Those are the three.
Yep.
It cannot be created nor destroyed, but then how was it? Where was it originally?
It started with the Big Bang, effectively.
Right. We're just a Big Bang spread out. So the same amount of energy that was at the Big Bang in all of its forms is the same amount of energy that the universe has in all of its forms, just spread over a much larger area.
Yeah. That's
the entropy piece.
That's where the E equals MC squared comes from.
It's a violation of the law of conservation of energy because you can take small changes of mass and turn them into large portions of energy.
But the basic idea is that energy started off as energy and then became masses as the universe cooled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you can reconvert some mass to energy like occurs
an atom
in
bomb.
The sun.
Right.
So, I mean, since relativity was invented, we know that the energy and mass are kind of
interchangeable,
two sides of the same coin.
All right. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Well, we started the program with a doozy. 800-348-2551. We go over to Douglas in Saratoga Springs. Douglas.
Hey, thanks very much for the format and your panel, Ray. I'm always very impressed with this show.
So are we.
I'll try to be a little more succinct if I can with this question.
Good plan.
I'm a former teacher, and regarding the environmental and global warming situation, my question to the panel is, do you suggest, and it's a little unfair with your backgrounds, is there any example that you think clearly could be presented to naysayers of global warming that would be, I could kind of add to my quiver, if you will, of arrows of ideas? The one I always tried to use was the size of the Earth, and the polar ice caps and the melting factor are all very, very easy to calculate with borings and things like that. But the naysayers continue, oh, yeah, that's science. Panel, do you have any other very in the hand, if you will, way to approach these naysayers and the very dangerous collision course that we're on?
Well, could I start it? Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, let me start it just by saying that we have very good temperature measurements of the Earth over almost 100,000 years from ice cores up north. And generally speaking, the temperature of the Earth has varied by upwards of 8 degrees over the last 100,000 years. So we know that global warming and global cooling exists, and it's always existed. The trick is that over the past 10,000 years, the temperature of the Earth has remained constant to within about plus or minus 1 degree. And that has allowed civilization to exist. So the reason that we are in the situation we are right now with 7 billion people on the earth and farms and cities and things like that is simply because it's been very, very, very quiet over a very long period of time, which is unusual for the earth. So the question is not whether global warming occurs or not occurs, because we know it does. But the question is, can we survive as a society if temperature goes outside of the range that we're able to exist at in large numbers? So yes, we know that happens. We also know that since about 1980, the Earth has been warming up faster than the sun has been allowed to warm it up. So we know that we do have an effect there as well. And that could be shown very easily by just showing the temperature, comparing the temperature of the Earth to, for example, sunspot activity from the Earth.
Anybody else before we take a break?
Just that often people conflate the empirical evidence that global climate change is upon us with the causes of global climate change.
Right.
And so in the scientific community, there's really no doubt, and I'll be as absolute as science allows me to be, that there is global climate change, that we are undergoing a sea change of how the Earth is responding to the factors that exist. Where the debate, the discussion over the coffee table, around the water cooler, or at the scientific meetings exists is how much do each one of the anthropogenic activities that humans do, how much do they influence this? It's the percentages that are really where the uncertainty is. And I think that's sometimes people take that uncertainty and run with it and say, well, then it's not happening. No. It's happening.
All right. We need to take a quick break here. Barbara Brobbins is here, Jim Pickett and Ed Stander, and it's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, 800-348-2551.
Support comes from Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens Cheshire, Boar's Head Deli with daily specials, bakery, homemade fudge, smoked chicken, and rib dinners to go, plus fresh seasonal produce. Whitney'sFarm.com. The Hyde Collection in Glens Falls presenting the works of Rockwell Kent, who traveled the world but lived and worked in the Adirondacks. Through July 22nd, HydeCollection.org for details. The Saratoga Jewish Cultural Festival, announcing the 7th annual series of 10 summer events, sponsored by Saratoga Congregations and Skidmore Office for Jewish Student Life. SaratogaJewishCulturalFestival.org. Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York. Specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years. QFCC.com. And from Grapes and Grains, Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York. Offering wine and craft spirits from around the globe and from local artisans with weekly tastings. Stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins, grapesandgrainswine.com.
Let's do a quick science test for music buff Ed Stander. Ed, you're from the kind of like the 70s music. Who was that we just heard?
I was so busy talking about other things, I didn't listen.
The Dixie Dregs. Don't you remember the Dixie Dregs?
Of course.
Steve Morrison Company. All right, it's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. And we'll get back to the phones in a minute. First, we'll take care of some emails here. This one's from James. I like mildly spicy foods and was wondering what exactly makes the hot sensation to the tongue and mouth.
Capucin.
Capsicum, exactly.
What is it?
The pronunciation varies. Capsicum is the name of the compound, or capsaicin, sometimes pronounced. And it apparently binds to the same receptors that report high temperature. And
the chemist is correct.
So it's the same thing in all spicy foods?
Pretty well,
They're a class. It's a class of compounds.
Well, chili peppers specifically contain capsaicin. Black pepper, it's a different compound.
All right, that's good. Well, thank you for that. That was easy. This was from Ellen in Albany. I'd like to know how long sunscreen lasts, whether it stops being effective after the date stamped on the tube or bottle. I also want to know what are the most effective ingredients to look for. That's from Ellen.
That's a great question. The bottle stamp date is really very important because you've got it in a matrix. So what happens is you've got a compound that absorbs or reflects, depends on what type we're dealing with, UV light and dissipates it in some way, or converts it to non-nasty wavelengths. And what that does is it's sitting in something that can be delivered. Depends on if it's a cream or a spray. So there's different compounds with that. And then you usually have some fragrance because you need to smell nice when you put on sunscreen.
Right.
And then there'll be emollients, things to make it not dry out over time or to spread it thinner.
Yeah.
And that matrix is going to have a lifespan because those chemicals are going to react slowly but continuously in the bottle. And they're rated you know, if you're within a day or two of the stamp, you're good. But it depends on the environments. I keep a bottle in my car. My car's hot. It's sunny. Those are two bad things for sunscreen. Yeah. So I'm going to throw mine out before the expiration date. Jim?
Yeah. I agree. A lot of the lifetime, it has to do with basically the cream that it's in. That if you break that emulsion, that's not going to be... It just won't flow out
spread,
as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What if it's under pressure, like the spray stuff?
Those are usually oils mixed with heavier alcohols.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might be more stable.
Okay.
Some of the UVB absorbing compounds also might not be stable forever against water. They'll hydrolyze.
Okay.
As far as the really good compound for absorbing sunlight, like the oxybenzone, is the really good absorber. Unfortunately, it's being banned in places because it kills coral.
Hawaii, for instance.
Yes.
That was just announced the other day.
Now,
yes.
To get on my soapbox a little bit, there's a whole raft of excellent UVA absorbers that are used in Europe that have been, the FDA's just been sitting on them in the United States.
And why is that?
Because that's what they do. I don't know.
I thought the biggest problem was UVC, though. As far as the amount of UV energy getting into your body and causing melanoma.
Well, but by definition, there's no solar UVC. UVC is, is light of wavelengths shorter than around 290 nanometers.
Okay.
And there isn't any of that in sunlight.
Okay. This one came in. And by the way, you can call while we're doing the emails here. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, 800-348-2551. This is from Art in Pauling. The question is, regardless of how calorie-dense a food is it possible to gain more body weight than the food you are consuming weighs? That's from Art in Pauling.
Well, you can because there's always water, and there's water weight. So and you also have kidney function, and that can also change the amount of weight that you gain or lose significantly. If you think of some of your relatives who have been sick, for example, they could end up with a condition called ascites, which you end up with fluid buildup in your torso, and that's usually a sign of some grave illness. Mm. It really has very little to do with the calories that you're consuming and everything to do with your inability to excrete.
All right, but getting back to the initial question.
Yeah, I think with the initial question, since gram per gram fat...
It's 9 calories versus 4.
No, I guess the question would be how much water is associated with the storage of fat in your body.
And it's not really. The storage of glycogen is by far more water. Water and glycogen are combined, and those are complex carbohydrates stored. So
So I guess it's quite possible then, because
quite possible?
To gain more weight.
Gain more weight than you eat.
If I ate a half pound of Oreos compared to a half pound piece of meat.
After your pancreatitis bout, you'll still weigh more with the Oreos.
Yeah. It would seem to be common sense.
Well, there's also two other factors, which I know we've talked about this, but it's been a long time in the science forum since then. Your digestive system is not very efficient at absorbing protein. And it's... marginally efficient at absorbing fat. It's pretty darn good at absorbing starches, so sugars and starches.
Yeah.
So from a calorie per calorie percentage, you can OD on protein, all other things being safe. Let's just say that's the case because it's not always the case.
All right.
You could have a really, really large protein meal and you're not going to absorb it. It's just going to go through the digestive tract and come out, probably not in a comfortable manner either. And so you could eat more protein than you're going to ever absorb in a
okay.
meal.
And Ed, did you want to add anything to that before we get back to the phones?
I was just going to mention that if you're on a diet, the first thing that your body is going to start absorbing is the water.
Yeah.
So you're going to wind up losing, you know, 10, 15 pounds over a month. And then as soon as you, very shortly thereafter, it's all going to come back. So the water is able to go in and out of your system much faster than anything else.
All right. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. And David in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for doing a good show there.
Thank you.
My question is, global positioning, how does it work? And also, they're having a new telescope in space that will be acting like a global positioning device, mapping the entire universe. How does it work?
Well, as far as the global positioning system works, effectively what you need, what it's doing is the same thing that's done on Earth for your telephone. You can figure out where your telephone is on Earth very accurately by measuring the time it takes to get to a tower, three towers actually. And through those three towers, you can figure out approximately where you are. And in the case of the global positioning system, you've got the same thing, but generally speaking, you're using four satellites. And those four satellites, the time it takes for the signal to get to your machine, and there's an offset of two signals that allow you to determine when the signal was sent. You take those signals from four different satellites, and they can figure out the distance from your receiver to those four satellites, and from that you can figure out where you are.
And that new telescope works the same way, or what?
Well, I don't know about the new telescope being used as a global positioning system. That's something I haven't looked
into.
Because
it seems like to map the universe, when you're on an object that's moving and the universe itself is moving, it's really complicated, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you can determine the direction and height of the telescope very, very accurately just using accelerometers. So as the telescope changes position, that information is sent to it. And, of course, it has methods to correct itself. So if it starts to go off from a position, it comes back on. There's a telescope right now up there called Kepler, which is pointing at a very, very, very small area of space. It's been doing it for years, looking for planets. And it's able to do that and determine what's going on at each planet because it has a very, very accurate accelerometer system.
Jim.
Yeah, I was just going to say, with the mapping, it's a really tough trigonometry problem, but it's solvable, the things that you brought up about how things are moving around and where you're pointing. But basically, in the mapping the universe, they can determine then the position of the stars in the sky, the direction in which they are moving by shifts in the wavelengths of light, and the stars that are close enough to determine how far they are away by their shift in apparent position when they're on one side of the orbit of the Earth going around the sun compared with the other side, looking at the parallax.
Right.
And that's Jim Pickett, also Ed Stander here, and Barbara Brabets. It's the Science Forum. Thank you for that call, David. We appreciate it. And over to Tony in New Paltz. Tony, you're on. Hello. Tony. Oh, boy. Are you there, Tony? Okay. Well, sorry, Tony. And J.D. in Springfield, Massachusetts. J.D.
Hi. It's taken me till today to say, did I really hear this? But my astronomical information says that the pointer stars that indicate the North Star are the outer two stars of the Big Dipper. And I heard this prestigious science program say it was the hand, and I'm like, no, that's got to be wrong. So anyhow, am I right or am I wrong?
It's the two outer stars of the Big Dipper. They're called the pointers. And if you go down from them, the first star you'll see that's somewhat bright, and it's not terribly bright, is North Star.
Yes, and which is the tail end of the Little Dipper, which goes the other way and dumps into the Big Dipper.
Exactly.
From my elementary education, so I was taught correctly. I'm so happy to hear that. And so I'm so glad. Thank you so much for stabilizing my world again.
Well, thank you, JD. We appreciate that.
It's okay.
Very
you
much.
Know, it's always a problem. If there's one thing wrong, then you don't know what else is wrong. And
right,
if you learn that one thing early on, then who knows what's right.
And, you know, scientists do make mistakes. We just have to own up to them when we make them.
And are they good about that?
No.
Yeah.
Not that good. No.
It's a whole show.
All right, let's go to Pat in Malta. Pat, you're on.
Hi. Good afternoon. My 8-year-old granddaughter came up with an idea that, frankly, I think is ingenious when I started thinking about it, of transforming the way we collect garbage now and what we do with it, which is landfills or ocean, and making it in a global aerial endeavor, and then the garbage is dropped into relatively active volcanoes. And I'm like, you know, at first I was like, but then thinking about what her point is, it's really, I think, quite ingenious. If the heat from a volcano would indeed incinerate everything to the degree that when the volcano erupted, we wouldn't be spewing, you know, toxic magma every place. But, you know, you get her drift. And I think that's pretty smart. It would be hard to get the entire globe to go along with this or to, you know, get the idea to be accepted, of course. But every idea receives pushback at first. So,
well, actually, putting it in a volcano or putting it in an incinerator is pretty much the same thing. The big problem, the big problem is that in both cases, when you start heating up things that are going into an incinerator, they start producing different chemicals, different products, and they wind up going into the atmosphere.
Well, if they're not well regulated. Some incineration is much cleaner than landfill as far as off-gassing goes, from both a nasty chemical list and also from just a pure emission
standpoint.
But
that has to be captured, right?
There have to be technologies within which exist. And I'm not saying this is future. This is now. It's all really about money. You know, you could burn something or you can burn something and make sure that nothing escapes that's bad. And if you think about the evolution of landfilling over even my lifetime and the lifetimes before me, you know, people used to have a backyard dump and everyone had their own little dissipated backyard dump. And so you had to look at it, see it, have your kids play near it. So you kind of kept your garbage somewhat limited because you had to deal with it. Now we pay somebody to take it away and make it invisible, and we centralize it. So we end up with issues like the Colony Landfill, which has, there's evidence that there's material that's leaking from the bottom of it into the river or the Mohawk River. And so that centralization is really all of our problem, not just Colony's problem or Half Moon's problem across the river. This is the centralization requires all of us to weigh in.
Which is why I thought the volcano idea was ingenious, because that takes care of that problem.
It almost does. You're still centralizing the waste.
I know.
kind of back to the technology of the volcano. In a way, I think Barb and Ed are right that it's not any really different from incineration, except that it's less well-controlled. And a well-controlled design incinerator would do a better job than just tossing it into a volcano.
All right, Pat.
You also want to stay away from volcanoes, generally speaking, that are spewing out stuff. Because if you've got gases coming up, then the next thing you know, the bloody planes are crashing because they're getting ashes on them.
Well, you know, I wish we had a geologist on this panel because there are a lot of volcano items in the news.
Really?
And the Ring of Fire would appear to be quite active lately.
Well, actually, it's not the Ring of Fire. It's the,
middle.
It's a hot spot in the middle of the ocean. And I can talk about
the Ring of Fire also going on with the earthquakes.
If someone doesn't want to listen to Jim for a while and like to ask me a question about that, I would be glad to talk.
Well, I sort of just threw you.
What a panderer.
Passive aggressive science forum. I did kind of bring this up so you might discuss A, the Hawaii situation, B, all the earthquakes. It's like Canary Islands.
You're asking me? You're really nice.
People are going to turn the channel.
Yes, there is a volcano in the center of the ocean called Hawaii, and it is has a small problem because it appears that the center of Kilauea has been blocked, and that's why stuff is starting to go down the slope.
Right.
And fissures are opening up.
Fissures are opening up because it has to get out.
From the sides where all the real estate is.
Look, who's the geologist here?
I was in Hawaii.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, wow. He needs a nap.
Pray continue before we take the next break and sort this out. Go ahead.
Well, that's what's happening. So what's happening is now it looks like the center may actually be coughing starting to clear up again. And if it does, then we may have a major problem because then it's going to off-gas very quickly. And if it does, it could blow,
okay,
which is the danger.
Yeah, that's Ed Stander. It's the Science Forum, and what a happy bunch we have today. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabitz also on the panel, and you at 800-348-2551. We'll take one more here before the next break. Kate in South Hadley. Kate, you're on.
Hi there. I only heard the last few moments, unfortunately, of the skincare, sunscreen discussion.
Yeah.
But I am a consultant, and I'm not here to necessarily push the product that I consult for.
That's good.
But it's called Beauty Counter, and they are a company out of Santa Monica, California, and they are all about safer products.
Yeah.
And they provide non-nano zinc oxide. It's called Countersun Mist.
I see.
Which is powered by aerosol and not by aerosol, but by air. And there's no oxybenzones, which are banned in Hawaii, as you were mentioning, as a bad thing for the coral reefs, for the marine life.
Okay.
And certainly if it's not good for either one of those, it can't be all that great for humankind either.
Do you have a question?
I just want to throw it out there that there are alternatives.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, Kate, I appreciate you weighing in on that. We do have to take a break here, but thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum, and we'll be back.
Support comes from Boyden and Perrin Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. Hooked Seafood Company, Latham. Fresh seafood retail market and kitchen with scratch-made lunch and dinner menu. Raw bar, lobster rolls, whole belly clams, fish and chips available. HookedSeafoodINC.com. Colby Attorneys Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for the legal and professional community. Since 1939, ColbyService.com. Waterwheel Village, Galloway, New York, specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more. WaterwheelVillage.com. And from the Gift Garden, Bennington, Vermont, florist and gift shop featuring fresh flowers, arrangements, green and blossoming plants, home decor, candles, gift baskets, on Main Street, thegiftgardenvt.com.
All right, Ed Stander, you're a 70s music buff. Who is that?
King Crimson?
Wrong, no. Close, sort of. Dutch prog rock group Focus.
Focus.
Jan Ackerman on the lead guitar.
Oh, God.
How about that, huh?
It's been so many years.
You see. That's what we're all about here on the Science Forum. Ed Stander's here. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabitz. The number's 800-348-2551. Say, Barbara Brabitz, what are you doing this summer?
When I'm not taking care of Ed, who's obviously sick,
yes.
I will be working on environmental water quality on the Mohawk Reach again.
Oh, good
so
for you.
This will be, our fifth year, working with Riverkeeper to collect samples along the river once a month. We do a blitz. There'll be about 8 students and about a handful of faculty.
Oh,
we'll
that's
go
terrific.
Out and grab that, and then we'll be checking out whether or not there's fecal material in the water.
Well, there we go.
There we go.
Again, I'm sorry
that
I
protein.
Asked. This one came in via email from Richard. Can we bore a hole through the earth so people could travel from one side of the world to the other?
Ooh.
We can't go down further than about 7 miles.
And that's as far as we have gone?
That's as far as we've gone, and that was in Russia, because the Swedes said that if you dig deep enough, you'll find oil. And they kept on going until what happens is, as you get down far enough, the earth gets hot. And the hole actually starts to close up around the drill stem, and the whole drill starts to spin instead of the bottom.
Oh, interesting.
Yep.
And, kind of in principle, when you get down far enough, you get to the molten core.
Right.
And you're
then
not,
what?
Yeah, then you're not.
Why is the core molten? Is it radioactive? What keeps it molten? In other words, Mars lost its molten core.
Yeah. The size of the Earth.
And its magnetic field as well.
It's mostly the size of the Earth. It just hasn't cooled off completely. There was actually a project at one point called Project Moho to drill a hole into the Mohovian discontinuity, which is below the crust.
Yeah.
And about the same time as the hole was almost there, there was a movie that came out called A Crack in the Earth.
Yeah, well, great movie. Dana Andrews,
That's right, where they blow up an atomic bomb to get through the last bunch, yeah. And a whole piece of the Earth shoots off into space.
Yeah.
The project stopped right afterwards.
Really? I gotta love people who believe science fiction more than they believe science.
Well, all right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. And Scott in Pittsfield. Scott, you're on.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
So a few years ago, there was a Vox Pop, and the topic kind of was revolving around how air-dried clothes smell so good.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
All right, so I kind of changed it up this winter because I remember way back when our dryer was on the kaputs, hanging out our clothes, and they still smelled awesome.
Yeah.
So this past winter, when it was, 14 below and whatnot, I took a shirt that I had been wearing. It was dirty. All I did was wring it out in some cold water and hung it outside.
Yeah.
The next morning I came, it was stiff as a board.
Mm.
So I brought it inside. Within a matter of seconds, it was, loose, and it smelled good. And it was dry. Why is that?
Interesting.
Well,
it's great.
The dry is from a process called sublimation, in which the ice, just if it has a little source of heat energy, goes off into the gas phase. You'll see that, for example, on a sidewalk that has a little bit of ice on it in a sunny day in the winter.
When it's cold.
It doesn't melt, but still it'll go away because of sublimation.
Okay.
Same why your ice cubes are never the same size. When you go into the freezer, if they've been in the tray for a while, they will shrink, and that's a sublimation effect too.
Yeah, when I lived in Newfoundland, they used to put, everybody would put their clothes out during the winter, and the ice would form on it, and then the wind would pick it up and drop it on the ground, and they'd be freeze-dried. Effectively, the ice would all peel off of
neat.
It. And it worked really well.
Huh.
And then the other thing is that sunlight, of course, has UV in it, and UV can destroy some of the molecules that you would consider foul-smelling. And then there's also an ozone effect, but that doesn't take place as much in the winter as it does in the summer. Ozone's also a clarifier.
Well, Scott, thanks for the call. We appreciate that one. That was a good one. 800-348-2551. So then a theoretical space-age washer could use less water and pipe in some UV?
There are industrial washers, believe it or not, that are completely sonic.
Really?
All you need are sound waves.
Huh.
You don't need any cleaner. You don't even need surfactant. You can just shake it clean.
What about...
That's kind of what my husband sometimes does with his socks on the floor. Yeah. But
dogs do that, too.
Yeah, yeah. I'll just shake myself clean.
Wow.
But that's where I think we're going to go in like 40, 50 years when water becomes a big, big problem, is that we'll pay to have the technology to sonically clean our dishes, clean our bodies, and clean our laundry.
Well, sonically cleaning a body might be tricky.
Well, no, they've done it.
Dangerous?
They've done it in space trials and so on.
Wouldn't you need ear protection of some kind?
Yes, you will. Yep.
Then your ears won't be clean.
Well, on the inside.
Depends on the frequency, too.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551, and Aaron in Belchertown. Aaron, you're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm really enjoying the show today.
Thank you.
And I just had a question regarding the collecting all the trash and dumping it in the volcano idea. And this is actually something I thought about before, but what about collecting all the trash and basically shooting it into space at the sun and just letting it burn up in the sun?
Expensive.
Yeah, expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive. And I don't remember what the science video was that I saw. Hitting the sun is harder than you think. It takes a lot of rocket energy to actually slow it down enough to drop it into
the
sun.
Well, why the sun? How about Venus? It's close.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to slingshot. The issue is that the gravity will pull it towards the sun, but then it'll slingshot around it.
Yeah.
Kind of like, like one of those Jimmy Fund things where you put the quarter in and it goes around in the circles rather than straight down the tube. It's kind of what would happen with the sun. So you do need the rocket energy to shoot it down the hole.
It would only be $40 million per 1,000 pounds, too.
Yeah.
We'd have to work on that
a little
bit.
We could just work on our recycling efforts.
Another dimension or something.
Got to talk to Mr. Musk.
Well, thank you, Aaron. We appreciate the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. And Patrick in Clinton Corners. Patrick, you're on.
Okay. So I'll do a disclaimer. I'm not calling on behalf of myself. A friend asked me. is it true that people get shorter with age and that noses and to grow?
Noses and ears continue to grow.
Yes. The shortness, longness factor. The gravity compresses the discs in your back. So the soft part in between the bones, the little shock absorbers in your back, even without degenerative disc disease, will kind of harden and shrink. They lose their bounce, like cushions on a couch will kind of lose their bounce after a while.
Yeah.
And the same thing, your ears do continue to grow in length, and the lobes get longer again from gravity, but the length is there, as is the nose. So when they do those, this is what the kid would look like 20 years later to try to find the kids that were stolen by their parents. They lengthen the nose of the kid and they droop the earlobes. Huh. I went to a fascinating talk by an anthropologist artist who does these renderings in both 2D and 3D in order to try to identify either the individual who matches the skull that's found or to try to time progress some of these children who were abducted. It was a great talk.
My parents still haven't found them yet, though.
Yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah, two things. The eyeballs don't change,
okay,
which is very unusual. And second of all, on the last question, I forgot to mention that if we started pumping garbage into the sun, the mass of the sun would increase and we'd slowly spiral into it.
Okay.
So it's not a good idea.
All right. Well, Patrick, your connection's not too good, Patrick, so we'll let you go. But thank you very much. 800-348-2551. Welcome to the TB ward. That is the Science Forum. You all right there, Ed?
I'm fantastic.
So is it allergies or is it something communicable?
It's finals week. It's okay. Dealing with
this is what we do.
Dealing with
year.
Life.
I mean, this is a rather small student. Are we all going to get it?
No, no. Unless you'd like to take the test.
What's the test?
Well, it's 47 questions about astronomy.
No. Let's go back to the phones. Mark in East Dover, Vermont. Mark, you're on.
How you doing? I'm not the one that believes in chemtrails, but I'm always having a problem. My cousin, he's like adamant about it. I've been hearing about it for 50 years. And all I keep hearing is, you know, they're poisoning us. They're spraying us, you know. Can you guys put this to bed once and for all?
Oh, yeah, we wish we could.
I do notice one thing. I've noticed recently, and I'm not going to support him, but he is true. It seems like all the planes now have, you know, vapor trails. When before, you didn't see every single plane have it.
All right, Jim is shaking his head, so let's let Jim go first.
Yeah, Jim, please.
Jim, welcome back from vacation.
Oh, gee, good. Well, number one, conspiracy theorists generally don't put much stock in facts, so there's no way to put it to bed. The simple fact is that, yes, it's little clouds of water droplets and ice crystals, but behind the plane from combustion products from the engine. They've always been there. There are pictures behind high-altitude bombers in World War II of contrails. The perception that you see it probably now more than before is because of confirmation bias.
More planes?
No, well, yeah, there are more planes. And I mean, how well do you remember what they looked like 30 years ago? It's vapor trails.
I should mention that I did some study on it. And effectively, if there's anything in JP4, which is the jet propulsion fuel that's used in most planes, if there's anything in there besides JP4, the plane wouldn't fly.
Oh, nice.
So it would have to be something that's shoved from the side into the contrail to make this happen. It would be very, very unusual, and the amount would be enormous.
Okay.
The plane couldn't fly.
I hope we put that one to rest for you, and it's the Science Forum on WAMC. Over to Nina in Middletown. Nina, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I have a twofold question. First of all, about two Fridays ago, I was with some friends, and we looked up at the moon, and it just looked different. It was beautiful. And we took pictures with a phone. And when we looked at the picture, not with the naked eye, but with the picture, there was a round orb to the right top of the moon. But number one, what was it? And number two, why couldn't we see it with our eyes?
You want to take it?
I think it's sundogs, only in a moon. So when the atmosphere has a certain dryness to it and coolness to it, you get two images that can appear on either side of the sun. They're at a very specific angle. Is it 12.5 or 22.5?
Yeah, they're caused by ice crystals,
yep,
actually in the upper atmosphere. And what happens is the light gets hits those ice crystals and then refracts down towards you. They're sometimes called glories, sometimes called dogs.
But she didn't see them. Was this not an artifact of the actual picture-taking process?
It could have been fog on the lens as well.
Or you could have a filter in your phone because it's a night. You know, the phones these days actually give you much choice. It'll be like, oh, you're taking a picture at night. And so it enhances certain portions that you may not be able to see with your visible eye. Yeah. So
it was a perfectly round orb, you know, that we saw on the pictures.
Yeah.
Someone said it was Venus, but I mean, I don't know if that's...
Well, that's possible.
Was it going around the moon? How big are we talking orb?
Compared to the moon, it was, I don't know, it would look like a ping pong ball to a basketball.
Ah, that may have been Jupiter then. Jupiter
is
very...
Yeah, that's not a sundog. The sundog would actually be larger than the moon.
Jupiter is very, very close right now. In fact, it's the closest it's been for years, and so it's very, very bright.
Okay, and it
follows the moon.
Right. And it would pick it up on my smartphone, but not from my eyes.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you're not... Because the moon is very bright compared to Jupiter. And so the moon would effectively take most of your view. It was probably there. You just didn't see it.
My phone, which is just an Samsung Android thing, it does this kind of modification of the bright objects and dims them in the picture so that they don't overwhelm the rest. And I have to turn it off, like for my sunset and my sunrise photos, because I want it bright.
Right.
Then I have to turn that function off in order to get the brightness that I actually see with my
eyeballs. That's a sensible answer. And Jim?
Yeah. Was the moon close to full?
Oh, we lost her.
Oh. Well,
yes, because it was close to full.
Yeah. And then, yes.
So, 2 weeks ago.
I think Ed is exactly right.
Okay.
That the dazzling effect would just make it so you couldn't see it by eye.
All righty. Over to Steve in South Glens Falls. Steve, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I love this show.
Me too.
I don't have a question, but I have an observation. And I turned in after you identified your guest, so I'm afraid I don't know her name.
Barbara.
But earlier talking about the crack in the earth and throwing a chunk of the earth off into space, she had said, you know, it's amazing that sometimes people will believe science fiction and not science. But remember, it wasn't too long ago that landing on the moon was science fiction, and I distinctly remember reading Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which at the time was science fiction, and it is no longer. So sometimes science fiction is predictive.
You are correct. I mean, you look at my smartphone and you look at a tricorder from Star Trek and you wonder which one's which.
Yeah.
So
on the other hand, I don't believe that a chunk of the earth would go off into space in this case, but I don't think you can generalize.
Well, I think I was commenting on the fact that a multi-billion-dollar project was abandoned because general consensus from a population that was scientifically ignorant thought it should end.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, that was pretty dumb. I agree.
Well, thanks, Steve. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I just mentioned, by the way, that Jonathan Swift predicted the two moons of Mars back in the 1600s and actually predicted where they would be before anyone ever saw them. So science fiction goes all the way back.
Hmm. All right. Do we only have about 45 seconds here?
Oh, boy.
Do we have time to take one more?
Let's try.
All right. Let's do it very quickly. Anthony in Cooperstown, you have about 20 seconds to state your case.
The question goes back to your mention of the Big Bang. I always think about this. How does something from nothing get defined in science? Either the universe started in a total vacuum, or it didn't, and if it didn't, then et cetera, et cetera. So
it's a huge question.
Nothing.
All right, let's go in the last 10 seconds and make this happen.
E equals mc squared. You can take a lot of energy and put it in a very small space.
We don't know that there was nothing before the Big Bang. We just can't measure it.
Yep, science, physics ends at the Big Bang.
Yeah. Amen.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here today. We want to thank Barbara Brabitz and Ed Stander and Jim Pickett for being here. Thank you for listening on The Great Calls today. Sorry if we did not get to your call or email. Support comes from Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts, offering annuals, perennials, vegetables, trees, and shrubs, indoor and outdoor plants, and information for landscapes and gardens. HadleyGardenCenter.com. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, featuring new styles for 2018. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. And Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Thanks again to our panel for being here. Thank you for listening. And thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Deb Malik took the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we delve into the pages of the Immigrant Cookbook, a culinary celebration of the many ethnic groups that have contributed to America's vibrant food culture. Right now, stand by for news.